Mark Steiner, and once again we are joined by one of our great mystery writers who writes for both adults and children, has written many, many books, has a provocative column in the Miami Herald, and is joining us here in the cold of Baltimore for a little bit. His brother used to work for The Sun, and he's with us now, Carl Hiaasen. Good to have you with us.
You're good to be back, even in the winter.
Even in the winter. Even in the winter.
It's cold.
But and your new book is a young people's book that just came out called Scat.
Yes, yes. Set in much warmer climes than this.
Yeah, I feel warm just holding the book in my hand. So once again, you hit the young people's trail with your books, like Hoot, and you've decided to stay with kids.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Hoot was sort of experimental, and I never expected it to do as well as it did.
Became a movie, even.
Yeah, or dreamed of it doing that well, and then came Flush, and I got so many letters, and the kids just want more and more and more, and you know, having a 9-year-old of my own, and I know what a thrill I get from seeing him pick up any book, mm-hmm. you know, to put down the iPod or the laptop just for a few minutes and read a book. And it seemed to me I had some sort of obligation to keep writing. And the letters are so great. I mean, it's just an audience that you want to stay in touch with and you want to stay connected to. For a writer, especially a cynical old newspaper journalist, it's pretty exciting to get the kind of mail you get from kids.
There's something about that newsprint that makes it cynics of us all, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, you go through most of your career believing that the civilization is doomed, and then you start getting these incredibly smart and clever and perceptive letters from kids, and you realize they're going to be running the whole show in a few years, and maybe it's not doomed after all because there's so much smarter, so much more politically sophisticated than I was at that age.
They really are. They're amazing. And so this is a genre you may stay with for a bit and we come back to from
Yeah, what I do is I sort of alternate with the adult novels and the kids' novels. I'm in the middle of another grown-up novel now, writing it, but mm-hmm. So I'm taking a little time out to promote Scat. But I do get energized by writing for this audience, so it is something I'm going back to because I enjoy doing it.
Well, let's talk about the book a bit. I really, it's one of those, whether you're an old man like me or a kid like we have at home, I mean, the book kind of – It just runs through it. You can really kind of – it's really fast-paced. You can kind of get into the rhythm of this thing quickly and not put it down.
Well, one of the liberating things about writing kids' books where the kids are the main characters, the protagonists of it, is you can hit the ground running with the plot. They do have backstories and they do have histories and they do have a family life, but it doesn't take – dozens and dozens of pages to flesh those characters out because they are relatively innocent and they're young and whether they're 10, 11, or 12, and that can be complicated. But telling their story takes so much less narrative time than it does when in my adult novels when you have characters and you're trying to explain why they're on their fifth marriage. I mean, there's a little bit more backstory. Most of these kids don't have that problem yet, so I'm liberated to sort of run more with the plot.
But you do get into the kids. I mean, and with how they look at life is you can kind of harken back to your own childhood, but of course with sons that you're raising, you can kind of just watch them go through what they go through and.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, to some extent, when I first started writing these books, I didn't know what the secret would be because when I'm writing for an adult novel, I mean, a lot of the other fiction I do is really therapeutic for myself. I mean, it's really like a lot of satire. It has a mm-hmm. a target, and it usually comes from sort of a sense of injustice or even anger. And I didn't want to lose that sort of smart-ass tone that I have in the other novels because kids dig that. They love that.
Well, they love it.
And at the same time, obviously, I didn't want some of the adult situations. It was not necessary. You know, 10 and 11-year-old kids aren't exposed to the same sort of things that a
– No, you see it through the eyes of young – the adults are seeing through the eyes of 11-year-olds.
And so I had to step back. And, of course, my wife says it was easy because she believes I've never grown up. And she said, no wonder you can write for kids. You've never grown up. And to some extent, that's a blessing because I remember what it was like, in this case, being 10 and 11 years old and wandering through the woods with my friends and with the idea that a panther might be watching us, this mm-hmm. mythic animal, a predator that no one ever saw in Florida because there's so few of them. When I was a kid, there was maybe 20 left in the whole state. And so it was almost like looking for unicorns. And we had no fear whatsoever, but we were out there looking for tracks and looking for mm-hmm. any evidence. And I remember that, how exciting that time was, and I wanted to be able to put that into the pages
of the book.
What
part of Florida did you grow up? What part of Florida?
Well, I grew up in a suburb of Fort Lauderdale called mm-hmm. Plantation, which at the time was the last municipality before nothing but swamp. And that's where I spent, you know, you got on your, I was telling somebody, what you did after school is you got on your bike and you rode west until the road ran out, which wasn't very far. And then you got off and you just explored. That's what we did when we were kids. We were fishing and camping. I mean, it was a great childhood. It doesn't exist in that part of Florida anymore because all that is under concrete now, bit of it. So.
And I sense your, and I was going to say this later, but since you said it, I was going to talk about that sense of anger that clearly you have about concrete being mowed over. I mean, you have this wonderful Echo Avenger in your book. Twilly Spree?
Twilly. He's from one of the grown-up novels. This is the first time I've ever done that.
He was in another one of your books.
Right. He was in a book called Sick Puppy.
Sick Puppy. That's
appropriately
right.
enough.
Right.
That was a very grown-up book. And this is the first time I've ever transplanted a character from that world.
Into his child's world.
But he just happened to be in the neighborhood, and he fit into the story.
Uh-huh.
And but he does come into play, and he becomes a figure in the two kids in this book, Nick and Marta. Have an unexpected encounter with this guy, and they've got to figure out what they're dealing with. Is he a psychopath? Is he a hero? Is he just a nutcase? You don't know. And part of the fun of it through the eyes of the kids is first impressions, you know, because you jump to conclusions. There's a teacher in this book who disappears during a field trip. And Mrs. Starch, and she's not a popular teacher. She's very tough and stern and can be very brutal if you mess up in her class. In terms of verbally, she can make you feel about 2 inches tall. So there's not a lot of sympathy for her, and the kids are all live in fear of her, yet she disappears, and Nick and Marta have to make a decision. There's a mystery here. Where did this woman go?
Mm-hmm.
And while their friends are content to say, who cares? She's gone. Good riddance. They feel a moral obligation to try to find out. And in the doing this, they run into people like Twilly and others. And I'm always interested how kids appraise grown-ups on first time they see them, and first impressions are important, and how often I was wrong as a kid when I saw somebody and assumed something,
mm-hmm.
and found myself, and including teachers who I thought, oh, this is going to be the worst year of my life. She's a witch. I'm never going to survive. The end of the year, I learned more in that class than I did in all my others put together.
I remember those too.
You remember those? Yeah, it frequently happens, and that's the kind of teacher Mrs. Starch might well be.
She was tough, Mrs.
Yeah.
Starch.
Yes. Very tough.
But I, you know, when you talked about Twilly Spree, I was going to throw out at you was that you had a bunch of series of great quotes, and one of them was he had this anger, gut full of anger,
mm-hmm.
At concrete and being paved over.
Right.
I mean, it's like if you were an eco-terrorist, you'd be Tully.
Yes. I mean, I do. There are a couple characters in the stuff I write that I think I certainly live vicariously through, and I certainly have said things that they say in the novels. Now, I've never had the nerve to do some of the stuff that they might do, but the anger is the same. It's the same feeling, you know. It does make me angry that I can't take my 9-year-old to show him some of the things that I saw when I was a kid. Now, I, on the other hand, I can take him to this one area that I'm writing about here where there are some panthers. He may never see one, but you're among them. And when I was young, I was told these animals aren't going to be around by the end of the 20th century. And now they say there may be as many as 100 of them left because the efforts of a lot of good people who cared, scientists and biologists and forestry people. And part of this story is about the fact that, you know, good guys can make good things happen and you don't give up. But at the same time, no, I mean, there are things I wish I could show Quinn that I can't anymore, and at least where I grew up. And it does make you angry as a parent because these were special places to me as a kid, and now they're literally shopping malls. They're literally 8-lane expressways, I mean, as far as the eye can see. And it was inconceivable to me as a kid that not only would they be changed, they'd be obliterated. You just don't think when you're 10 and 11 and 12, you don't think on that grand scale of annihilation that humans are capable of perpetrating when money is to be made.
We're talking with Carl Hiaasen. His latest book is one of his young people's books called Scat. He's an award-winning author and writer and columnist for the Miami Herald. He's making his way through Baltimore to talk about his latest work, Scat. Back to the novel again, specifically. You wrote Hoot, which was about the burrowing owls.
Right, yeah.
And saving these owls and the environment.
Yeah, again, and another page out of my own childhood, yeah.
The burrowing owls.
Were very real, and they got wiped out where I lived. And I wanted to write a book, but the ending was different. It was happier, because my friends and I failed. We tried to save them, and we couldn't. And so you're selfish. Writing is a very selfish sort of vocation, as you know. I mean, the first person you have to please with the story is yourself.
Right.
And so in my novels, it wasn't going to turn out that way for the owls. It was going to turn out better. And so it was just something selfish I prefer to do.
Well, also, yeah, but you have to – it's also inspirational. I mean, other people are reading it, and especially young people are – I think there are a lot of young people that I've met, my own 11-year-old Maisie as well, is that really see themselves as environmental activists. They really see themselves as wanting to save the earth, and they really believe it. These kids are really into it. I mean, it's not something
It's unbelievable. You hit it right on the head. My friends and I, when we were young, we were reacting sort of out of just, this is what's happening to our neighborhood. This is what's happening to this creek we were fishing in. It's been filled with pollution. We're not looking at the big picture. We didn't know global warming. We didn't know what was happening in the rainforest. We didn't know about the ozone layer. And you talk to any 8, 9, or 10-year-old now, and they can give you a good lecture on it, and my son included on this. But the awareness, and I have to believe there's an instinctive feeling. I think kids are born with this innate sort of love of wild things and wild places. And you see it if you've ever been with a kid at a zoo. Mm-hmm. Where he gets his first look at a tiger or a grizzly bear or something. It's the same thing when you're driving through Yellowstone Park and their faces are pressed against the glass because they want to see what a buffalo looks like. And you don't teach these kids. This is a natural reaction from kids, and it's a wonderful thing. And I don't know at what point we lose that as grown-ups. When do we lose that same passion for this the planet we share? At what point?
Every adult, you haven't lost it.
I haven't, but I mean, I come from a place where lots and lots of people either lose it or put it aside when there's profit to be made on the other side.
That is the truth, unfortunately.
I mean, I could put 1,000 condos there, or I could make it a nature preserve. Let's see where that's going
to
end up.
But see, now as an adult, I keep trying to get back to the scat, so I'm going to come back to me. But as a columnist, that's where you get to do that. I mean, you go after. I've spent, knowing you were coming, I went back, and since I don't read the Miami Herald every day, I went back to. We looked at a bunch of the last 15 or so columns you wrote, 20 columns maybe, and I mean, you really, really go on the attack with developers and folks who are kind of misusing the public trust. It's not like, that's that way, that kind of intellectual visceral world of yours to protect the environment and our way of life.
That's why I haven't given the column up, is because, first of all, it's a privilege to have that forum in a place you grew up, in a place you care about. I mean, I was born and raised there, and to have a voice still after all these years is an honor, and that's the reason I keep doing it. But you're right. My mission with any given column is to ruin somebody's day. I want some politician somewhere to open the paper and really get sick over his breakfast at the idea that he turned up in the column. And now he's got to explain to his wife and his kids what he really does for a living. And then I'm happy knowing that they're miserable.
I love it. I'm going to come to some of your columns before we end this conversation a little bit later. But Scat.
Yes, the book.
You're here for the book.
That's right.
That's okay. Well, and we're talking with Carl Hiaasen about his latest work, Scat. I started off asking about the burrowing owls and from Hoot, mm-hmm. but here we have the Florida Panthers.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about a football team.
No.
We're talking about
the hockey team.
The hockey team.
That's the great irony, is they build a hockey arena on the very edge of the Everglades in in what was once panther habitat and is now one of the biggest, you know, blighted urban sprawls you can imagine. And they name it after this species that they've almost wiped out.
They had a nerve to name it after this species.
Yeah, they should have named it, you know, the Florida tractors or the Florida bulldozers.
Florida concrete.
Pavement. Florida panthers. What's that? You know, it's great. It's only in Florida. It's wonderful.
But I do love that part. You talked a bit about this, but I'm curious about you and you spend a lot of time in the environment. Mm-hmm. You go out and
not as much as I'd like to, but
have in the past.
Yeah,
and I understood from something else I read that you went out and. Maybe not met a panther, but you were part of.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Right?
I did see.
What was that story?
Well, when I was a kid, you know, we never got to actually lay eyes on one. But I've always when I was working at the newspaper, I got a call from a great guy, Dr. David Mayer,
who you dedicated the book to.
Yeah, who passed away last year tragically in a plane accident. But he was one of the great panther experts in Florida, and he said we're doing it's a top secret sort of thing we're doing. We're tracking down these remaining animals with dogs, and we're putting collars on them, and we're tracking them from day to night, where they go, where they hang out, what they're eating, why they're dying off, all this stuff. You want to come out with us. And so the first panther I ever saw, he had these incredible dogs that don't bark. They're trained not to bark.
Senges?
I don't know. No, they're hound dogs from the south.
Uh-huh.
That I guess they if they bark, they get fired. So they don't bark. And they come all – they're jumping all around completely mute, and the only time they make a noise – and it's a very hair-raising noise – is when they've got a cat treat. So they turn them loose and – you know, about 20 minutes later, we hear this ungodly howl, and we get there, and there's this panther at the top of the tree, and they shoot him with a we blow up garbage bags and make this gigantic mattress, and they tranquilize the cat. It falls onto the mattress, and it's very exciting. The cat turns out to be pregnant. This is the first one I've ever seen.
Wow.
And they give it a vaccination. They check it out, and then it comes to, and off it goes. But they track that cat in about 3 generations of her kittens by radio collar, and they got a great idea of where they go. Their habitat is almost vanished in Florida, but they've managed to carve out these little areas in ranches and cattle land, and where there's some deer population, and they're hanging in there. But Dave was an expert on this, since that was the first time, and then the only one I've ever seen in the wild.
Other than this.
Yeah, well, I went on a couple others where they were releasing some, and I've seen them, and you know, I've seen some that have been hit by cars and rehabilitated, but they can't be released. There's a lot of roadkill, unfortunately, with panthers. But anyway, I was driving back from the Keys one night, late at night, rainy, on a road called Card Sound Road, which people in South Florida are familiar with, and it was kind of a desolate highway from Upper Key Largo toward Homestead. And in the headlights, I see this incredible beast by the side of the road, and I knew what it was instantly. And it was just hunched over. It might have killed something by the road and was eating it. I don't know. But in the next millisecond, it was leaping, you know, through the rain into the woods and gone. And it was that fast. But there was no mistaking what it was, because there wasn't anything else that big that lives there. And that was it. And that was my one brush in, you know, 50-odd years with this cat. But it was still exciting. I felt like I was 11 years old again.
No.
And it was very cool. And I'd called a friend of mine and who was familiar with where the animal. And I said, "Have there ever been seen in that area?" And he said, "There was one animal that was on that had been seen there in the last couple of months. That's probably the one I saw."
But
it's pretty bad when you can count on one hand and say, "Oh, I know that one. I know that animal."
What we've done it's obscene. I mean, what was it like when you? With the one that was tranquilized, just looking at that beautiful animal lying there.
It was kind of surreal, because they're closely related to the cougar or the mountain lion, but they're not the same color, and there are some differences that have evolved over the generations.
That's the same species?
There's a big argument whether it's the same it's a subspecies or an offshoot of the same species. There's a big genetic argument. And a few years ago, they tried to, because of inbreeding, there were so few animals that they were worried that they were going to be dying off even faster. They released some Texas cougars in the population to try to get the gene pool a little more healthy. And to some extent, I think there was some breeding, and then there was also some fighting. And the scientists differ on how successful it was. But But clearly the population is more today than it was when I was a kid. But I just wanted in this book to if I could portray for a kid what it's like to be out in that country, knowing that something like that was probably watching you from the top of a tree somewhere.
I love that. This book also has a lot of interesting little side stories to it, and the people in it are just – I love the kids, Nick Waters and Marta Gonzalez.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But the Nick Waters, you even threw the Iraq War into this.
Yes.
Uh-huh. But from a child's perspective.
Right.
Which I kind of really thought was very subtly powerful.
Well, I hadn't read – we all know the cost in terms of dollars and human lives of this war and also the war in Afghanistan. But what I haven't read very much of in all the coverage of the war – and all these brave men and women who are coming home with debilitating injuries, some very, very severe injuries, unlike anything of any other combat that the United States has been in, because the roadside bombing, you know, the makeshift bombs were so brutal. And Nick's father joins the National Guard, like thousands of other folks join the National Guard, thinking he was going to be on domestic sort of weekend duty in this
right.
country. Next thing you know, he's shipped off to Iraq, and he's injured, and he's coming home, and I wanted – there are thousands and thousands of kids who in this country whose lives have been touched in very large ways by this war, either a mother or father, an aunt or an uncle, brothers, sisters come home. And I don't read very much about that, and I just thought it would – from a kid's point of view – I know it's out there, and I know these kids are coping, and I know they have questions, and they have questions that a lot of us have been asking ever since mm-hmm. this started. And so, Nick, this is not a political statement. His dad is coming home a different person, and there are moments in the book when he asks and he wonders why, and he makes a sort of a comment to himself at one point that no one has ever really been explained to him why his dad went or what exactly his dad was fighting for over there or why anybody was shooting at his father when they were supposed to be going to liberate a country. And these are perfectly normal questions that still haven't been resolved entirely in the dialogue that the grown-ups are having in this country. So that was why I just wanted him to be a kid who had a lot on his mind. His mom, he wants to be strong for his mom because she's faced with, you know, her husband's coming home injured. But at the same time, he's a kid, and he's worried, and he's scared,
yeah,
and he's confused.
Yep.
Yeah, but he wants to be with his dad every step of the way on the rehab. And at the same time, he's got to solve this great mystery that's sort of overtaken the school that he's going to.
Right, this teacher.
The missing teacher.
And the missing student.
Yes, and there's a student who, and this again about first impressions, and I know you think back your own childhood. There was always, in my education, always some kid in the back of the class who was bigger than everyone else.
And my elementary school was Eddie McDonaldson.
And he'd skipped. He'd been held back
right.
once or maybe even 2 years in
tough
those
guy.
Days. Tough
day,
you know.
Tough
and
guy.
He's in sixth right. grade and he's shaving already. You know the guy. And he's got like chewing tobacco.
Right.
And you just steered clear of him if you had any brains of all. You didn't taunt him. You didn't make fun of him.
No,
you just understood that he meant business. And there's this kid whose nickname is Smoke, and he is believed to be an arsonist. They know he's had something of a shady criminal past, but. They need to go to him for help, and it's a daunting thing when maybe not the biggest kid in the class, and you're approaching a kid that everyone is scared of or worried, or they say he's nuts, don't go anywhere near him. But he holds the key to some of this secret, this mystery, and they at some point Nick and Marta have to get Smoke's help, but that also is a revelation because nobody is really who they seem to be the first time, and he turns into quite a different person from their point of view. And he's got a troubled life of his own, as a lot of kids do. His
and
home
life and a crazy dad.
His dad is crazy as a bedbug, and basically he lives in a house that's ruled by a deranged parrot or a macaw.
A macaw, right?
That his father has adopted and has now runs that house tyrannically, so that you can't even
speaks three languages. Is it?
Yeah, three or four, and you can't even walk into the kid's house without being attacked by this bird. And so it's complete chaos at home, and it's a miracle the kid's even sitting in a classroom at this point. So they have to cope with some of that on their way to solving this mystery.
But the mystery they solve, and the protagonists in the book, I guess in his own way, deranged former oil man and
mm-hmm. well, the scam. There's obviously in all my books. There's always
a scam.
There's a greedy scam at the center of this, and this was based on a real thing years ago. There's actually oil drilling that goes on in the big cypress area of the Everglades. And the oil quality isn't great, but they get several hundred thousand barrels a year. And there's oil rigs in the middle of this wilderness, believe it or not. And it's been a bone of contention among environmentalists, debated. And there's a family in Southwest Florida owns most – at one point owned most of this that part of the state, the Collier family, and the Collier County is named after them. And they very generously offered to sell all their oil leases in the big cypress to the state and federal government for a very tidy – I forget what how many millions and millions of dollars. And everyone said this is a great environmental opportunity to get these – well, then they began looking at it, and it became clear that it was a wonderful deal for the Collier family and not such a great deal for the taxpayers because the amount of oil was somewhat minimal. But for a while there, the state and the federal government were talking about buying up oil leases. So the scam in the book is there's a guy – if he can get his hands on some of this property and say there's some oil there, he has a chance of selling it to the government for an absurd amount of money, more than he would ever have made off the oil well itself. But he has some suckers in Washington who are happy to pay for it, and he's right there. It's his own little bailout, and he's at the middle of this. But it involves him setting up a lot of heavy equipment right in the middle of this panther habitat, this very pristine area, and he has to cover up what he's doing so that they don't find out who he is. And all of this goes into the mystery. But the scam came right out of the front page as usual. I mean, I got the idea when I looked at that. When I heard that they were offering to buy up the lease, I said, oh, somebody's going to make a killing here. If somebody, you know, it's just a perfect opportunity for a scammer to get out there.
But it's interesting, when as the novels you write, these kids' novels especially, that the villains in these novels I mean, as an adult, you could say, okay, but simplistic versions of a villain, but they really are emblematic of what is going on, because you're writing for children here.
That's right, absolutely.
So they're emblematic of what, in some ways, you and some of us are in this world try to fight against for a better world. To try to in terms of the environment and what we, and but so they're really emblematic of those people.
Yeah, and I don't find them to be hyperbolic at all. I mean, if someone had 2 years ago said I'm writing a novel and there's a guy in there who's modeled after a guy named Bernie Madoff, who's rips off governments, people, $50 billion from governments and from banks and from millions of taxpayers. Investors, and you would have said, you know, he pulls off a Ponzi scheme for 50, get out of here. I mean, my editor would have said, no, come on, get real. That couldn't happen. Not with the SEC watching.
Never happen.
So villains are sometimes less complicated than you think, and just when you think you've exaggerated one or created one that's an exaggeration, a real life one comes along and pops on the front pages, and you go, holy cow, it's worse than we thought. You know?
It is. It's the stories you make up, and there they are for real.
Worse than we ever dreamed.
So what is your real feeling about I think I'm a Twilly Spree again. I really like the guy.
Yeah, he's one of my favorites, too. And I've only, like I said, used him in one other book.
Right, but what he represents. And what are your thoughts about that whole notion of you know, that you put it, Echo Avengers or Monkey Wrenchers from the Earth
Monkey
First.
Monkey Wrenchers, yeah.
And they came out of Earth First. And
he invokes Ed Abbey, who was, you know, of course, the original anarchist, environmental anarchist. And but I think in Twilly's case, there's a redemptive motive as well, because his father was a real estate scammer and a scoundrel and a complete greed head, as Jimmy Buffett would say. You know, I mean, and Twilly feels some genetic burden that you know, not to turn out that way. And he saw what had become of places he liked as a kid. And he really sticks to himself. He's a loner. He's not I wouldn't call him a bomb thrower. But he definitely, when he sees something bad going on, he takes whatever measures he feels are appropriate to stop it. But there's a lot going on inside of him. There's a lot of quiet rage, I think. And that's what we all live with at some point. I mean, there are people that are simmering the whole time. And I think I'm probably one of them, and trying to sort of say, okay, there is, you know, that all is not lost. There are ways out of this. We've got to, you know, there's right ways and wrong ways to go at this. I've had the luxury of having a newspaper column to vent in. I've had the privilege of being able to write novels where I can satirically disembowel characters like that and feel a great deal of satisfaction afterwards. But for lots of people, they don't have that kind of an outlet. I mean, they just kind of have to keep it under control, and he's one of those guys.
Hey, good guy, too. We're talking about Scat, Carl Hiaasen's latest work written for our children, but also for us. If you're like me, you enjoy reading young people's books. There's something that's just so straightforward about them and enthralling and engaging, and this is one of them. And he's in Baltimore here to talk about his book as he travels the country doing just that. See, this is actually the beginning of your tour, too, because the book just came out.
It did. I'm only going to be on the road about a week, and then I go back to Florida and do some events down there, and then probably do some more publicity later on. But this is the first surge of, and of course I pick winter and you know the worst possible weather. I've never walked on ice in my life, and I'm out here skating around.
You've never walked on ice in your life?
Not this kind of ice. not parking lot ice.
Ice.
Yeah, it's very challenging. So, this is when the book came out, and this is when you're on the road. I'm not a big traveler in any case, and traveling in the winter is not high on my list of, you know, when I was flying up to New York at the beginning of the week, I went on the weather.com or something, and I see the forecast as ice pellets. And I said, what the hell is an ice pellet? I mean, I've heard of sleet, and I've heard of hail, and I've heard of rabbit pellets, but I've never heard of ice pellets. What does that mean? I found out. Not a good omen. Not a good way to start.
Well, maybe it's a little grist for the mill for another.
Yeah, I don't know. I've done all the research I intend to do on ice pellets.
Well, you won't find them in the Everglades.
No.
We hope not.
No.
So, the characters again in this book. I just want to talk about her for a minute more. Mrs. Starch.
Mm-hmm.
We won't go to the end of the book.
I don't want to give it away.
We're not going to give it away. But I just love how tough she is in her classroom. I mean, what she does when you – I mean, you throw up in her classroom.
Write an essay.
Write an essay.
Yeah. We've all had those teachers. No matter what, you could come in with three broken limbs. That'll be a good subject for an essay. Well, you know.
How dare you break a limb in this class?
Yeah, exactly. But then outside the class, they're a different person sometimes.
Right.
And there's another dimension to them. Yes, she's got an interesting – Nick and Mart at one point are so concerned that
the two main characters of the book, the two –
Yeah, that some foul play has come her way. And even though they're terrified of her and they hope they never have to have her in class again, they're still good kids at heart, and they think, we got to find out what happened to her. So they sneak out to her house, which is out in kind of a scary part of the woods on what would be, I guess, the east side of Naples, the Naples area in Florida. And they get in and their eyes are made very wide by what they see. And she's got all these animals just very delicately. They're taxidermied. They're stuffed animals. They're preserved animals. But they're done in a way that is quite moving and breathtaking and spooky at the same time. And they can't figure out what they've stumbled into. And it will take them a while to figure out what she's all about. But that's not what they expected to find when they went into her house.
That was not their image of her in class.
So. But people are full of – grown-ups are full of surprises. Kids are full of – part of the – you know, part of growing up is learning that, you know, don't assume anything. You know, don't assume anything.
Right. I mean, whether it's the wealthy transplants or the paranoid fathers, there's all these great – strange characters flow through the book.
Well, this takes place at the kids are in a private school, and so the rules are a little different at private school, and you have – if you're the headmaster of the private school, you have to keep certain parents very happy because they give a lot of money to the school. There's a whole different political dynamic in the private school system. And so when a teacher disappears, it's a hard thing to explain. It's an awkward time for a headmaster when one of the teachers just seems to vanish off the face of the earth on a field trip. And he's got to, of course, placate and sort of settle things among the student body and then worry about what the donors – the publicity is something they can't abide.
Not that kind of publicity.
A private institution, like they don't want to be in the headlines. If one of their kids gets in trouble, it's a big deal. It's a black eye to the school, and it means the donations go down. And, you know, there's a whole cascade of events. So that seemed an appealing political arena for me to write about, because it's not just – the public schools where everybody's, yeah, all right, what the heck? There has to be something of a cover-up involved.
I wonder, when you talk about political landscape, I have to – it just makes me think of some things I've read recently that you've been reading. you don't mind me taking a little diversion over to your columns.
No,
in just a
not
minute.
At all.
but I wonder what you think. You wrote a very nice piece about Obama when he won.
Mm-hmm.
About what it says about America.
Yeah.
And the different things. I wonder what you think it means for places like Florida. I mean, what it means, I mean, where there's this kind of, really is a political war in America over the environment of the future, over race, over many issues.
Yes.
Florida is still a kind of a Republican bastion in many ways.
Yeah.
And so what do you think it means for your home state, all this?
Well, he carried Florida, which was remarkable.
Right.
And I would have never believed it. In fact, what my column was about, I had met him in the spring, April of 07. He had very bravely come to the Vero Beach area, which is a very conservative area politically. And he was addressing a small group of people at a private home there. And not all the audience was entirely sympathetic or friendly, but they were curious. Who is this guy? He at that point was not a front runner. And I went. My wife wanted to go. She was very excited and wanted to go. And I went with her. And I listened to him. And I met him and talked to him a little bit. And we were leaving. And I said, and she said, "What do you think?" I said, "He's a very impressive guy, a very sharp and impressive guy, and he's got no chance whatsoever." And she goes, "What do you mean?" She's a little bit younger than I am. And I said, "But you haven't been through the '60s, so you don't know. But there is no way in my lifetime that an African-American with a middle name of Hussein is going to get elected president of this country. I'm sorry, honey, but it ain't happening." And that was my cynical self. And it's a good example of how wrong you can be.
I had to digress only because I said the exact same thing to Valerie, exactly the same thing. And she laughs at me now all the time. Saying,
My wife does too. She goes, "What do you know?" She goes, "You're writing a column. You're real smart. What do you know?" But there was an element of it's sometimes the whole point was it's nice to be wrong sometimes. It really is nice to be wrong. But coming from our generation where we had young charismatic leaders in the past and for a very grim period of through 63 through 68, uh-huh. they got shot down, most uh-huh. of them, literally shot down. So you learn after a while not to get your hopes up. And you see such reactionary and such depressing sort of events occur in politics that you just don't think – and the whole point was I don't think 4 years ago he could have possibly – been elected, or 8 years ago. I think it took a national emergency, a crisis, and a crash of such dimensions as we've not seen in our lifetime to either open people's eyes or open them up enough to say, okay, give the guy a chance. We're in big trouble. How much worse can it get? Mm-hmm. How could he possibly be any worse than what we just went through? And maybe that's what it takes to open the door, because I think if we were going along and the economy's chugging along and we're not in one inexplicable war and another very dangerous war, if all those situations don't exist, I don't think they're going to take a chance on it.
I mean, the change I saw in your home state with the numbers of younger Cubans who voted for Obama.
Oh, yeah.
That switch alone.
Remarkable.
Signals a not just a demographic shift, but a cultural and political shift.
Unbelievable.
That you couldn't have predicted.
Well, I knew something was happening when they had the early voting, and people were standing in line in the sun 4 and 5 hours, a week and a half ahead of the election to vote. And they were young people. They were new voters. They were people holding babies and with umbrellas. In my lifetime, I've never seen that kind of enthusiasm for any – not for Kennedy – not for any election had I mean, even after Watergate, when Jimmy Carter was running against Gerald Ford, and the country was as bitter and cynical as it could possibly be after Nixon, there wasn't that kind of not see that kind of excitement there for Jimmy Carter.
There's a joy and excitement about this election that I've never. I think America's never experienced ever.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary, and he is not Superman, and he's not superhuman, and he has. I wouldn't trade places with him for $1 million. But he's smart, and he's got some smart people, and you got to keep your fingers crossed.
I was thinking you wrote this funny piece about Blagojevich, and the Satan, which cracked me up. It was just really very funny. This telephone conversation.
Thanks.
It really was one of my favorite columns of all time. I think it's just great. I think it should be like a little quick.
Yeah,
play.
It was a tape. It was a secret tape of one of his tapes of he's calling Satan, trying to sell him Senate seat, whatever he wants. Oh my God, the guy is incredible.
He's no longer governor of Illinois.
No, he isn't
as we speak. But you write about him, and you also had this column about your speaker of the House, and I kept thinking about the corruption in politics.
Sansom? Ray Sansom.
Ray Sansom.
Yeah, yeah.
Speaker of the House of the Florida.
A real piece of work, yeah.
I mean, and the parallels here.
Yeah, well, I mean, it just, again, if you invented these characters, if you invented Blagojevich for a novel, it transcends Tom Wolfe, anything Tom Wolfe could have.
Right.
Doesn't it? I mean, doesn't that guy, where would you put that clown? Where? I mean, he's so unreal and everything about him. And in our case in Florida, just sort of business as usual with Ray Sansom. He's a Speaker of the House. And he at a time when every school budget is being hacked to ribbons and teachers don't know if they're going to be working next year and whole language programs are being cut, lunch programs are being cut for kids in our schools. He steers over the course of 2 years $35 million to this small college in his home in a place called Niceville, Florida. I'm sure you've heard of it. It's a great academic learning center, Niceville, Florida. And I'm sure the folks are nice, and I'm sure they deserve a college. $35 million. And mysteriously, on the day he becomes Speaker of the House, they announce that he's taking his new job, in addition to being the Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives, is a newly created vice presidency position at the university for $110,000 a year, which they say is connected in no way, whatsoever to the $35 million that he's managed. And he shamelessly said, oh, no, I would have got that job anyway. Oh, sure you would. So anyway, he's now under the subject of several investigations. But again, completely shameless and you know, unrepentant. And now he's saying, well, you know, I'll cooperate in any way. He's now got lawyers. So that's
lawyers.
All you need to know. Now he's got lawyers.
I mean, and it's, in a lot of ways, it's the kids in your books. I mean, the Blagojeviches and the Sansoms are the people that they fight against. These caricatures in real life are the caricatures in your books.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
You know?
When you sit down with your kids and try to explain to them, you know, real life happening, such as Blagojevich, or if you ever have a history talk with them about Watergate. Oh, yeah, we had a president that they wiretapped the people they didn't like, and they had an enemies list that they targeted people. They had enemies list, the president of the United States. And they look at you like, was this a movie or what? And you say, no, this is what we lived through. And so that's why I don't find any of, you know, I mean, even though the characters jump off the page at you, they're really no more extreme than what you come across, you know, in Florida on a regular basis and nationally occasionally, certainly in Illinois, apparently. The villains, the bad guys, they're out
here
there.
In Maryland as well.
Yeah. Yes. Spiro Agnew.
What?
Yeah. You know, one of the worst.
Our mayor is now under a cloud of, you know, this is all this. It's just insane.
Yeah, it is. And you don't want to get your kids so jaded to politics, because if you looked out at that sea of faces on the mall, you know, on that Tuesday, and all the hope that you saw.
Well, that was gonna, and the hope is like the kids in your book are always full of this stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, they believe that they can save this environment around them. And you must in some ways believe it could happen too, or you wouldn't put those voices
wouldn't, there. You wouldn't. No, you're exactly right. I wouldn't waste the time writing about it if I didn't see. I see every letter I get, and I've gotten thousands of letters from kids about Hoot and Flood. The letters are just, you know, they're really incredible. And you read them, and as cynical and crusty as I think I am, and I think, wow, you know, this is smart. There is more than a glimmer of hope. They're much smarter than I was at that age, and they're much more savvy. And really, the only lesson is it doesn't have to be the way it is. You can make it better, and you can make a change, and you can make a difference. And the other thing I tell them is your generation can't possibly do a worse job than my generation did. It's impossible. You can't screw it up any worse than we did. Okay.
I hope
so
not.
Have a crack at it. You know?
I mean, I hope not. I mean, is there a part of this book you'd like to share with us? You'd like to read when you're in public?
I haven't read at all from it. I can try. No, I haven't.
There's so much dialogue, so it's not as like you're just reading.
You know, I haven't even looked at a section that would, you know, time-wise to know what to look at. But I mean, if you want me to take a shot at something, I haven't. I'm new on the tour, so I haven't done that.
That should have been my job to help you. I should have found a place.
Well, we don't give something away, you know.
Right. No, I don't want to give anything away.
I can read a little bit from the beginning about Mrs. Starch in the classroom.
Okay.
If I can, and I'll find a little spot maybe to stop so we don't.
And I'm going to just put this little thing here just in case this little funny part about Dwayne's squad.
Oh, Dwayne.
Squad Junior. I'll just put that there. Look at that and maybe I'll just read another just to give our listeners a sense of what you have there. I'd love to have them.
All right.
Whatever you're comfortable with is fine with me.
Okay, let me see. Let me see what we got here.
Next time, your next book, I promise, I'll pick the part up.
No, I should. I haven't done any reading, but I'll just read the beginning, okay. And I'll get you a little bit, a little taste of Mrs. Starch. Okay, this is the first chapter. The day before Mrs. Starch vanished, her third period biology student trudged silently, as always, from the into the classroom. Their expressions reflected the usual mix of dread and melancholy, for Mrs. Starch was the most feared teacher at the Truman School. When the bell rang, she unfolded stiffly like a crane and rose to her full height of nearly 6 feet. In one hand, she twirled a sharpened Ticonderoga No. 2 pencil, a sure sign of trouble to come. Nick glanced across the aisle at Marta Gonzalez. Her brown eyes were locked on Mrs. Starch, and her thin elbows were planted like fence posts, pinning her biology book open to Chapter 8. Nick had his own textbook in his locker, had left his own textbook in his locker, and his palms were sweating. "Good morning, people," said Mrs. Starch in a tone so mild that it was chilling. "Who's prepared to tell me about the Calvin cycle?" Only one hand rose. It belonged to Graham, who always claimed to know the answers but never did. Mrs. Starch hadn't called on him since the first week of class. "The Calvin cycle?" she repeated. "Anybody?" Marta looked as if she might throw up again. The last time that had happened, Mrs. Starch had barely waited until the floor was mopped before instructing Marta to write a paper listing 5 major muscles used in the act of regurgitation. Nick and the other students had been blown away. What kind of teacher would punish a kid for puking? So there you get a sense of the atmosphere in that classroom.
This is great. It was a huge amount of fun to read.
And, well, thanks. I'm glad.
Really was. It was great, and it was very powerful. I mean, the messages, our children need books like this, they can both kind of enjoy and get through, but also kind of instills them. Even though you're not a preacher, it instills them a kind of a sense that they can actually do something and to fighting for our earth and becoming a good human being. So it's good stuff.
Thank you.
No preachy, which is why I like.
No, not at all. I just write a story, and if they connect with the characters, they get the message from the characters, not from the writer.
It's always good to see you.
It's great to see you again. And this is a cool place. This new studio is
very
cool.
Yeah, we're very lucky.
It's very cool.
It's very good. Carl Hyacinth Scat. Thank you so much, man. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me back.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we will look at one of the many ways our new president, Barack Obama, has inspired people. So don't go away. And first, let me remind you that The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. Over 70 years later, they're still there to help people during difficult times. For more information, go to mecu.com. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Barack Obama has already been an inspiration to many people, getting lots of people involved in politics in different ways than they might have ever imagined. Our next guest, Isela Marin, is one of those people. Born in Belize, she's now a Vermont transplant. Isela turned her excitement about Barack Obama to something she can share with other people, placemats. She visited us recently in Baltimore, and here's part of our conversation. Let's talk about these mats. We have these placemats in front of us here. I love this idea. You have these placemats with the faces of all the presidents of the United States, a color photo of Barack Obama, a little bit of the Constitution. You can see the American flag, and on the back, a description of each president, their vice president, when they were born, when they died, first lady, education, occupation, lawyer, the political party they're in. So tell me, what is all this and why?
Here's why. I have 3 kids. I have a 12-year-old daughter, Casey, a 10-year-old, Liam, and Connor, who's 8. Mother of 3. Always trying to find a way of how I can communicate with my kids. And what better place is at the table? Dinner. I have their undivided attention. We're all living this busy world. We're all driving in cars going everywhere. And, you know, I just find the dinner place, to be the place that I can educate my kids, talk to them, know what happened during the day. And just came to my mind, you know, looking at an old placemat I had way back when, and said, you know, why don't I create my version of this placemat for for my kids. And so I started to play with it. Had a good friend of mine, Holly Boardman, who said, let's take a stab at it and let's see what we come up with. So this is what this placemat is all about. It's about education. And so what I did was I created a placemat. It's 11 by 17. It mm-hmm. has all the presidents on it. And our newest president, Barack Obama, he is a little bit more prominent on the placemat because he's our newest president.
Yes, he
so,
is.
And so we went into production. This started just about Thanksgiving. And next thing you know, everybody saw it. And everybody's like, oh, you should go big with this. And being a small, you know, person I am, not small person, but just being the fact that I'm not this big marketing person, I said, oh, I don't know. And so I had to find a print shop that would print it in time. And everybody in Vermont just came to help out. You know, we made the place.
The whole state.
It's unbelievable. It's, you know, the people that came said, oh, you know, the printer was great. We'll push for it. Then we develop a TV spot that, you know, we did a TV spot with an 877 number that ran through a couple states, you know, and it was amazing. The actresses, they're all from Vermont. Then we, you know, created the website, and it was born. It's something that I never anticipated would be going the way it is going right now, you know. So, and the back has information about all these presidents, you know. It's information that, you know, one of the information that we found is that not every first lady was wife of the president.
Mm-hmm.
So we have John Tyler, who's the 10th president, and he had three first ladies. His wife, while he was inaugurated, then she passed away. His daughter-in-law then became president, mm-hmm. and then he got remarried. And so there was three first ladies in Tyler's administration. Yes. I thought that was amazing.
And he was only president for 4 years, right?
Exactly. You know, and imagine. So it was just, it's just something that, you know, kids need to educate themselves, but not just the kids. It's parents. Parents interacting with their kids, learning about this historic moment that we're going through. You know, it's not just about a placemat. It's about how can we learn more? How can, you know, kids out there say, wow, I know this about the president. I know that. Because you know what? Our kids don't know anything about the past presidents. And they need to learn about history and moving forward and, you know, all the wonderful things that this country has to offer.
And, I mean, you did this also, it seems to me, besides being a kind of a perfect timing given where we are now and kind of looking at this and maybe getting some young people excited, really young people excited, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds to kind of delve into our presidential history and just get into this mat. I can see them doing it at dinner tables and the games you can play with this. But you did this also, this whole philosophy around the idea of families being together and spending quality time at the dinner table.
Yes. Studies have shown that families that eat at least 5.5 times a week are better communicators. They have better relationships. And for teens, you know, from the time you're a young kid and you have that time with your family, it bonds you with your family. And, you know, I personally feel that way, that I need to spend that time with my kids. I have their undivided attention. You know, they tell me what happens with them during the day. You know, we share, you know, they say, Mom and Dad, how was your day? And that's important to me. You know, we need to understand how each family has issues. They have their problems. But when it comes back to a family, it's unity. It's what we hold together. It's that love that we have for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And family dinners are very important to me. And that's why I think the placemat was an important way of me showing how I can interact with them. You know, there are placemats out there about numbers and multiplication, and they're all educational too.
So what have you learned yourself doing this?
I have learned a lot. Not only have I learned about this country and all these presidents, but how my kids enjoy having that time with me. You know, now it's you know, they focus on speaking to me about, you know, the presidents. My husband is a love for history. And for him, it has bonded him with the kids. So it's just brought us together more and mm-hmm. learning that, you know, it's life is short. And we have to learn a lot. And it's just been amazing. It's just been an amazing trip doing this since just around Thanksgiving and where I'm at today.
I mean, I can see you taking a time like this and just playing all kinds of games for the kids to learn the facts about the presidents of the United States of America. Just asking them these questions. about births and deaths and who they were and when they were president. And it'd be really fascinating. This is a get young people really stimulated to.
And you know, what better way to learn about history but the leaders of our country, you know? And these placemats are to educate our young leaders that are coming up into being leaders of this country. So, you know, whether you're African-American, Hispanic, you know, Caucasian, Jewish, it doesn't matter. It's about how we can learn about this great country we live in and our presidents.
That about wraps it up for us today. Thanks to Asela Marin and Carl Hyacin for joining us this hour. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is also made possible by Urbanite Magazine. This month, Urbanite hits the road with an issue of travel stories, from regional day trips to journeys back in time. Urbanite is available for pickup at over 800 locations throughout the region and online at www.urbaniteBaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and is produced by Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Christina Arison and Judith Lloyd. Our theme music is by Juan Matthews of Clean Cuts. And thanks to Nick Shostrom for helping engineer us today at Clean Cuts. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner, and take care.